Welcome today to our interview series of outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Alain Chenet, top global innovator, serial entrepreneur, executive, and scientist. Alain, you get this incredible background. You've been a very, very successful researcher and widely known throughout the world, and we really appreciate you and thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Alain, you recently keynoted at the World Congress in Amsterdam about the developments in graphics, which you have led over many decades. Can you talk about the innovations in the graphics field and future innovations to watch for?
Sure. I mean, one of the key things that we've seen in computer graphics is a dramatic increase in computational capabilities. When I started out, to render a single frame of any image would take many minutes and typically tens of minutes. Trying to do any sort of real-time animation was completely out of bounds. It wasn't anything that we could actually even foresee at the time. And yet today, you look at what we can do on your typical gaming consoles or on the high-level graphics cards that you can put in your personal computer, and you see that we're doing hundreds of frames per second at very, very high levels of quality. So that's changed entirely the whole business of graphics and how we actually look at things. What that's done is two major things. First of all, what we've been able to do now is to get immediate response in terms of what we would expect to see. So that gives us tools that are now totally interactive in terms of being able to go and manipulate three-dimensional objects in real time and get immediate feedback, seeing your representation of an entirely virtual scenario right up on your screen and having it change as you interact with it. So being able to go and push and pull points, to be able to sculpt, to do things that were technically impossible when I started out 30 years ago. Today, this is run-of-the-mill. This is actually what we do in all of our tools. And to the point where our children, or at least my children, take this for granted and have never known a world where you couldn't do this. Now, the graphics have gotten better over the past couple of years, but the idea is we still have much more that we can do. And so getting that increase in speed enables two things. First of all, it's being able to do more. And secondly, it's being able to do better quality. Now, why am I trading off the two there? If you look at the types of innovations that we see, you can split them off into one aspect is doing things faster. So being able to do your games where you've got many, many, say, interactive elements all moving across the screen at once and being able to have them be independently animated, do things separately in a way that we couldn't conceive of before. That's one aspect, is being able to do a lot of these and do them fast. The second aspect is that if we can do a lot of these and we can do these fast, what we can also do in the same time frame is spend more time doing the calculation. Now, why is that important? It's because if I can spend a little bit more time, I can do more realistic rendering. I can make it look like the real world and make it to a point where you have a hard time discerning the difference between real and virtual space. So basically, the second aspect of innovation that we see is not only the speed, but the actual quality of the images that we're able to render now.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about some of the sort of the innovations, and again, which you have led in the graphics field. Where do you see this going then? Do you sort of see the Matrix kind of environment like in the movie where you can't distinguish it? You can live in this sort of totally immersive world?
We're getting close to that. What I see isn't quite what you saw in the Matrix. And again, if you look at the movies are trying to tell a story. They're trying to go and imagine something that would be compelling and make you want to spend that hour and a half to 2 hours in a movie theater to watch it. What I'm looking at more is to see what you can do with these technologies, to see how you can go and enhance the real world. So to give you a couple of examples, one of the fields that I'm really, really interested in is what we call augmented reality. So augmented reality is the ability to go and capture what's out there in the real world. So being able to go and capture video and add extra information about it. So basically being able to go and use this as a way to let you go and see things that you couldn't normally see. So let me give you a couple of examples. One of the projects that I'm working on is actually a virtual furniture placement software. So to go and explain what that means is basically what we do is we'll take pictures of, say, an office space, and then we'll interactively remove the existing furniture and let you place new furniture. in there and visualize it in the context of what your space actually looks like. So why is this important? Well, when you're actually shopping for furniture, for instance, so you're looking to go and redo your office space, you'll look at a catalog and you have to make a fair leap of imagination to be able to go and say, okay, well, this is what this furniture will look like in my office space. By using this augmented reality approach and really looking to see how we can do it. Now, what I can do is I can take my real office space, virtually remove all of the furniture that's in it, and start placing new furniture in it, getting extra information displayed on the screen in real time as you're moving these around. So what could that information be? Well, it can be the price of whatever I'm putting together, so I can actually get a quote in real time as to what it would cost to actually build out what I'm designing. It can be the constraints. So say if I'm working in medical space and what I need to do is to be able to go and verify that certain constraints are actually being held as we're placing this virtual furniture. The tools that we're developing, again, because they're so fast, because they allow you to move things around in virtual space in real time, allow us to add in extra information. I still have processing time available to me to be able to go and do calculations to validate that all of the, say, health elements, the amount of space between two medical instruments that's required to be able to go and meet the norms that are in place are actually validated as we're doing this. So all these things are really, really important things that we can do with this technology. The technology isn't just to be able to go and entertain, but it's to actually give you information in real time as you're manipulating it. And the key thing is with these graphics capabilities, I can look at not only what's currently there, but I can look at what could be there if I were to go and take a certain amount of action, such as placing furniture. So I can do what-if scenarios, be able to go and move things around, create them, remove them, adjust them until I get what I'm really looking for. So that way, when I finally order what it is I want to do, I've already got a very, very good representation of what it's going to look like, and I'm not guessing anymore. I'm getting that immediate feedback from the computer. The computer is giving me the ability to see this. Now, if you add on the ability to use mobile devices for this, I mean, one of the things that I'm most excited about is the use of tablets right now. The ability to carry this around, have full high-definition video available inside to be able to capture your data and overlay 3D data in real time as you're doing this gives you possibilities that we're only just beginning to discover. The fact that you can move that tablet around to look changes, your workflow completely. Because before, if you were to go and use a computer that had the graphics capabilities that are required to be able to do this, you were talking about typically a desktop solution, maybe a laptop, but you're not going to go carry your laptop around to point it at various things to see what they look like. The tablet changes that. It changes the way you use the computer. The computer becomes more an extension of your natural way of doing things rather than being a place that you go to. Your computer is now with you. Computer is portable. And portable in a sense that your arm isn't getting tired by carrying it around. I mean, you could take your laptop before and carry it around and use its integrated cameras to be able to go and do things. But it wasn't a very comfortable thing. It was awkward. Now what we're doing is we're actually finding workflows that are completely different. They're enabled by the fact that you've got very, very high-powered devices in these mobile units that you can use to be able to go and test scenarios out and see what you could get by moving your virtual space around and testing things out in the virtual arena before you get into the real world.
Now, you recently founded this really, really fascinating company, TrendSpotter. Can you tell us more about your role at TrendSpotter?
Sure. I'm chief scientist at TrendSpotter. So TrendSpotter is actually an interesting company. I was approached by my partner, Mark Zohar, who co-founded the company with me about 2 years ago, where he was complaining about using social media and feeling that he was totally swamped by it, that there was such a flood of information coming through that he couldn't make head or tails of it. So he basically challenged me and said, you're a math guy. You understand how to go and do this. Would you be able to extract the relevant information from a flood of social media and be able to tell me what's interesting? And so that looked like an interesting problem to me, and it was something that really got me excited and started looking at it. So we built a prototype. Took me a couple of months to actually test out the thoughts that I had to see how we could actually approach this, and developed a prototype that basically analyzes the tweets. So the first element that we looked at was Twitter. So if you look at Twitter, you're talking about several hundred million tweets every day. We call it the fire hose in terms of this flood of information coming at you, because it really is. We've never seen such volumes of data come out at you, publicly accessible, and giving you the ability to analyze them as they come through. So the big challenge comes when you want to look at this and say, okay, in this big fire hose of information, there are trends happening. There are things that are dominating. There are things that are coming up and that are more relevant than the rest. And how do you actually spot those? So what we've built is a tool that does real-time analytics. It means as the information comes flowing in, we update our evaluations of what the content is. So we look for things like links, like hashtags, like at mentions, the various elements that compose a tweet. And from those, we built an incremental analytics engine that basically tells you what the scores of all these elements are as they come in. Now, why is that important? Well, what it does is it lets me go and say, well, first of all, I only want to go and look at a certain amount of information, certain types of information. So why is that? If I look at Twitter any day of the week and I want to see what's trending, very likely it'll be something like Justin Bieber or the latest Hollywood blockbuster, but that's not really what's interesting to me. What I'm interested in is understanding what's happening in certain categories, certain aspects. So I'm a techie, I'm a geek. I would love to be able to go and see, well, what's trending right now in the subflow of elements that are relevant to technology, for instance. So what we've built out is the ability to filter by topic. So first of all, only looks at the tweets that are related to technology or related to science or related to economy, for instance. And from there, do the analysis to be able to go and see what's trending right now in the subjects that I'm interested in. It's actually pretty interesting because what we're able to do is to be able to spot the early acceleration phase of viral growth. So viral growth has been studied now for over 50 years. The original studies were actually done to describe the propagation of the flu epidemic. And this was work that was done at NIH in the States. Very, very intense mathematics to be able to go and do it. When that original work was done, we didn't have the compute power that we have today. So this was very intense calculations that would let you go and predict how much the flu would peak based on early reports of what was coming in. It turns out that if you look at how things propagate on social networks, the same math applies to describe the growth and the propagation of elements on social network as what you get. It's the same math as what you use to describe propagation of the flu virus, which is why we actually call it viral growth. There's a reason for it. Now, what we can do with that math today is I can take that math and put it on today's computers, and calculations that used to take days 50 years ago can be done in real time now. So we can actually spot the initial phase of growth, from that initial phase be able to go and predict how high it will grow, and be able to tell you before a topic has peaked that it is going to peak and how big it will be. And that's actually pretty amazing, because when you look at it, what it does is it lets you get a sense for what is interesting and what is going to have a major impact in social networks very, very quickly. So we're able to go and spot elements before they've peaked and before they've gotten to the point where pretty much everybody has seen it. Okay? Why is that important? Well, there are many aspects for that. I mean, what you're actually seeing today is companies are trying to adapt to social networks and trying to understand how they can interact with it. What's happened now is we've got so much more information coupled with the exact opposite that's happening to it is before, when you had more information, you had more time. Here, we're seeing more information come in coupled with less time in which to react to it. So why is there less time? It's because now what's happening is with these social networks, the information is going at a speed that we've never seen before. So to give you an idea, is we measure what's called the half-life of an element on social networks. So if you look at Twitter in particular, you can go and see how much interactions there are on any tweet, on any information actually being sent out there, and how long it takes for people to react. So we can define the half-life as being the period of time, statistically, over which half of the interactions on a given data item will happen. Okay? What we're seeing with that is where the half-life of information for propagation via email or via websites was measured in days, if not weeks. What we're seeing on social media is the half-life is measured in hours. And to give you an idea, on Twitter, when we look at this, we measure the half-life to be a little bit under 3 hours. So what that means is if you want to be effective and you want to get in when something is starting to peak and be able to have any sort of reactive power to be able to go and either reinforce a positive message or be able to attenuate the negative effects of something that's not going in the direction that you'd like to see, you've got 3 hours in which to do it to be effective. If you wait any longer, you're too late. So what's happening now is we've got these tools that we're developing to be able to allow you to go and manipulate this information, be able to be warned early enough to be able to do things. Now, one of the interesting things we see is when we work with companies who are starting to go and integrate our tools into their decision-making process is that it's not enough to have the tool that warns you. You also have to go and change your business processes to be effective. If your processes say that you have to get C-level approval to be able to go and publish anything on social networks, the very fact that you've put in that blockage means that you can't be effective. You've got to rethink the way you actually go and communicate. You've got to take into account the time factors that are involved in the social media. So it's actually a very, very interesting subject to look at, because when we work with various large companies actually using our tools and using it to be able to be effective, we always stress the fact that you can't just have the tool that tells you. You've also got to put in place the communication strategies that allow you to use those tools effectively. So it's a bit of a revolution in terms of how people have to communicate. And what it means is that it's pushing companies to allow much more immediate responses, that the folks who are in the front lines who are actually doing the communications on social media need to be able to communicate fast. They need to be able to have enough autonomy to be able to go and be effective. If they don't have it, they can't be effective. And that's a major change in the way most companies are actually set up. So we're seeing this happen with the tools that we've developed that allow you to know what's interesting, and coupling that with recommendations as to how to use these tools most effectively to be able to do things that are relevant in the time frames that are required by social media.
You know, it's interesting. You see some research in terms of stock markets and so on, and sort of providing some predictability out of that, or anticipating trends that are occurring in the stock market. Have you been approached by those kinds of companies?
Yes, we have. I mean, honestly, when I look at the stock market and I look at social media reacts to the stock market, not the other way around. Okay? Is, you know, we've looked to see what you find is there a high correlation between movement in the stock market and posts on Twitter or Facebook about a given stock? Yes, there is. But correlation doesn't mean causality. And this is, you know, a major mistake that a lot of people make, is to assume that since they see the correlation, they assume that they can use Twitter as a predictive measure. What we've been seeing is pretty much the opposite, is that, say, Twitter reacts to what the stock market is doing. There's a lag between the change in stock price or things that are happening and what actually happens in terms of communication. So our understanding of this, and, you know, again, it's one of those where you have to be really, really careful about how you actually use this causality model, is that one causes the other, but it's not in the way people tend to think. So we look at this and we're very, very doubtful of the ability to use Twitter to predict what the stock market will do. Now, does it have an effect? Yes, it does. If you see that there is a more and more communications about a company and that communications is very positive, say, we find that, say, if Twitter is going a buzz about sales of the 7-inch iPad, for instance, we may expect to see Apple stock react to that. But typically what we'll find is that it's the information itself, not the fact that it got communicated on Twitter, that is actually driving that element. It's the actual data that came in. So where our tools can be used is to be able to spot that publication when people start talking about it before it goes viral, before most people have seen it, to be able to go and do it. It's not quite as immediate as some people would like to think, but it can be a useful tool. But it's not something that actually predicts what the stock market will do. What it does is it gives you relevant information that an analyst can then use to be able to see what the consequences would be. Okay, so it's not a, you know, we don't feel that it's a direct predictor of what the stock market will do. We do believe that it is a highly correlated element to what's actually happening. There is a certain amount of information that comes through. We haven't seen any examples, and we've been looking at this because one of the key market sectors that we were looking at was the stock market, to go and see, can we help? And we looked, and it does give analysts relevant information, but it's more a way of filtering out all the noise on social media to be able to get these signals that will help you as an analyst make the right decisions and be able to understand what's actually happening. I don't believe right now that we've got the tools to be able to go and predict what direction a given stock will go in.
You know, it's interesting. I saw this research report where number of social scientists who are looking at sort of the attitudinal or behavioral shifts and using things like Twitter. And that was a predictive model for seeing the trends in stocks. So for, I think they saw something like an 80% correlation. So when the sort of the behavior was more negative, then they would see within the next, I don't know, 2 to 3 weeks, something like that, then a dip in terms of the stock market. And when they saw the trend more towards more positive tweets, then they saw maybe an increase in the stock market. So maybe some. So I was just wondering if that tool could be used to plot behavioral trends.
We can. It's, I mean, just to give you an idea, we can find it, but what we have to be very, very careful about things, and specifically when you look at statistics, correlation and causality aren't the same thing. And you really have to be very, very careful about this. So do you see a high correlation? Yes, you will. Okay? And we actually measure that. The idea is to see, can you predict? Can you use that the other way around to say, well, I see a lot of negative attitude. Yep, that's telling me something that people have lost confidence in a given product. You can use it in that way, but you've probably got better tools to be able to go and get the cause of that negativity. And again, what I was saying is, you know, if you look at what an analyst is doing, so a stock analyst trying to go and see what's actually happening on the market, they'll actually see where's that negativity coming from. Well, it's probably coming from reports of how well the company did in the last quarter or what their sales projections are for the Christmas quarter that's coming up. Okay? Those are the things that will actually drive the elements that people are reacting to on Twitter. You see what I mean? And that's where you really have to be careful about what you're measuring there. Do you see the correlation? Yes, you do. Are there other sources of information that might give you that information a bit quicker? Probably. Okay? Because what you're seeing is the people who are actually on Twitter and are actually posting are posting in reaction to something that they've gotten from elsewhere. They've seen a report on year-over-year sales for a given, for a given product. They've seen other elements. So there you'll see that there will be a negative or a positive bias based on what they've read or what they've gotten through the TV news or through some other channel. What my sense is in terms of when we look at this is that we will be able to spot the fact that people have noticed it because we'll see it trending. We'll be able to pull out the relevant information, but doing it automatically for me doesn't seem like the most efficient way of actually doing it. I think there are better ways of actually getting that data and having the ability to then go and analyze it appropriately to go and see what does this mean.
Now, you've had some sort of remarkable successes with clients using your TrendSpotter technology. So why is your technology, TrendSpotter, resulting in this dramatic increases in your client base and the demands on the level of service?
Oof. Well, I mean, basically what we're seeing is the major element that has actually pushed our client base up fairly dramatically has been our partnership with Salesforce. So we've now integrated our real-time analytics into the Salesforce platform. And that's actually raised awareness in terms of what we actually do and how you can actually use this to help you understand what's happening in your business in real time. Because that's really where we differentiate, is there are a lot of really, really good tools out there to be able to go and do data analytics on how well you've done in the past. And they're all based, and all, well, actually focused on looking at how did you do last quarter, how did you do last week. But it's always backwards looking. It's looking in the rearview mirror. And where we're bringing a different approach to it is to say, well, we actually understand how viral growth works, and we've known for about 50 years what the mathematics that describe it are all about. And we can use that, take the data that's coming in to be able to predict where elements are going. And it's that predictive aspect of the analysis that we do that's getting a lot of excitement, because up till now people haven't had those types of tools readily available. The mathematics have existed. The mathematics, again, aren't new. It's the use of these mathematics with a data stream that is wide open. Again, we've never had the ability to go and analyze hundreds of millions of public tweets every day. That data just wasn't available to anybody. It wasn't easy to access. What social media has done is made that data accessible to everybody. Now what we're doing is we're developing the tools to help you make sense of that data and use it to your advantage. And that's really where the big difference has been, is coming in and giving this new analytics aspect where the analytics isn't just backwards looking to understand how well you did, but it's also now we're bringing in this new element that lets you see where are we going and be able to take action on this to be able to go and move the needle in one direction or another depending on what you're trying to do. So again, if you see something that you would like to go and expand upon. You think is very positive for whatever you're looking at, you know, be it your brand, your product, your service. You can then reinforce the message based on what people are already trending about, what they're already sharing, and be able to go and get more bang for the buck. Conversely, if you see something that's starting to trend with a very, very negative aspect for what you're doing, you can start taking corrective action and start publishing, say, information that will help you counter the negative effects that you foresee of a given message way before it becomes a catastrophe. I mean, if you think of things like, well, to take an example with the, with the iPhone's antenna gate element, had the folks at Apple been able to see how massively viral the reaction to that was, maybe they could have taken action a little bit earlier. Maybe they could have looked into it to see, okay, our public is now getting very upset about this. Let's make sure that we've got an answer, that we can look into the technical aspects of this and see what we might do to be able to go and take corrective action. The idea is, you know, if you don't know that something's going on or you find out about it way after everybody has seen the message, you're too late. There's nothing you can do about it. You're basically a passive spectator seeing this happen rather than being an active participant that's actually trying to guide the direction in which the communications go. And that's really where we want to get people to be, is to be able to actively participate and make sure that they understand what's going on about the subject that they care about and have that information come into them early enough so that they can actually do something about it. And again, you know, one of the key changes here, as I mentioned earlier, is the really, really short amount of time in which you can respond to something and have an effect. If you go past those 3 hours, you're too late. So the idea is to make sure that you know about something that's starting to trend way before its peak and very, very early on in its growth phase.
And it's a really fascinating technology, and I guess you could see the applicability to business and industry and academia, media, governments. I mean, you name the field, there's an application. Have any governments approached you in any way, either at a national level or a regional or a municipal level?
Yes, we have actually been approached. None of them have actually signed. No governments have signed. We have, you know, anybody who's interested in public sentiments has been looking at our tools to be able to see how they might use them. I'm not aware of any government agency anywhere currently using our tools. But again, part of our tools are free to use, so we wouldn't necessarily know about it. You know, some of them, say our search tool, can be used without having to register with us, so we wouldn't know about that. We don't have any governments that I'm aware of, currently signed as customers, as paying customers, but I wouldn't be surprised if they started using it. Where I see more applicability is in the realm of politics, where, say, if you want to be going and giving a speech for a given candidate for a given election in a given region, what you'll find is there's a lot of variability between regions as to what people care about. Okay, people who live in Toronto may not care at all about the same things as people who live in San Francisco. Okay, there will be that regional variability. And if you're looking at things where you're making statistics based on what the current level of interest of somebody might be, being able to go and geolocate, because that's one of the other things that we get, is we can look at our statistical analysis. I talked earlier about filtering on subject matter. We can also filter on geolocation. So we can run our analysis on a given city, on a given region. So I can look at what are people trending about, you know, what are the subjects that are trending with people who live in San Francisco right now compared to people who live in Los Angeles. We can actually measure that directly and give you reports as to what's coming in based on whatever subjects you might want. So if you want to have maximum impact in terms of a speech you'll be giving or something of the sort, you can actually do that analysis right before you go into it and be able to adjust on the fly. You know, many types of tools that we could see there where that type of geolocation could be important. Say something like your local news. A local news station could, before they go on the air, check and see what is trending right now for a variety of subjects that we could choose to spend time on during our nightly news session. And those subjects can now be tuned to actually adjust to what people in your area care about. So there's a lot of ability that you're getting, say, to be able to analyze what people want to see or what people are actually currently discussing and be able to reinforce that to be more relevant for that type of element. performance. I mean, we can imagine all sorts of scenarios where being able to understand what your clientele cares about is something that can give you an advantage in terms of how you message your, you know, your statements, how it is you're going to go and communicate with them. Anybody who needs to communicate, who needs to go and be able to go and adapt to sentiment, to what people care about, could be using this type of tool.
I mean, it's interesting. I could see the applicability, and just so there is no limit. But even on the government side, there's this thing called the GST tax, which was initiated in our province, and ultimately it felled the government because they were unable to anticipate the sort of the opposition to it. Or I watched this whole fiscal cliff conversation in the U.S. and the impact it has on the stock market. You know, somebody goes out and makes some comment, and the stock market drops one percentage or a point.
Absolutely.
So it's you know, it's an amazing tool. I mean, I could just see how it could proliferate and be such an advantage to so many industries. Now, in your work at TrendSpotter, what are the challenges posed by big data?
Well, the key thing is the actual volume of data that we have to handle is the key, you know, the key element. So as I said, you know, two constraints. First of all, huge volumes of data, and coupled with the fact that we're trying to do this in real time. Now, one of the lifesavers for our company, and it has been actually fairly amazing, and what, you know, we've seen now is we couldn't have built this company as easily 10 years ago. And the reason for that is now what we've got is with the availability of services like Amazon or Google, who allow you to go and rent time on their machines as needed, what that builds up for you is the ability to go and scale to the level that you need and not have to go and over-provision your data center to be able to go and handle spikes. So to give you an idea as to why this is important. So assume that we're going into the U.S. presidential elections to cite something that we actually lived through watching our computers and the number of servers that we had in rotation. As we got closer and closer to the evening of the elections, we saw our usage go up dramatically. Okay. Not surprising. People were very interested in following this. We're trying to find out what was happening, what they could get in terms of information about this important event happening in the United States. They were using our tool more and more to be able to go and analyze that data and be able to understand what people were saying about it and what was actually happening as we were coming into it. If we had built this out in a more traditional means where we had built out our own co-location with our own data centers, with our own machines, we would have had to go and build it out for peak capacity right up front. So basically making a huge investment for something that after election night was no longer needed or wasn't needed at the level that we actually had to go and roll it out. So what that's done is it's given us the ability to rent the services that we need when we need them and be able to adapt our services to that. So basically what happens is as we need more and more capacity, we actually rent the time on these machines. When we no longer need that capacity, those machines are put back into the pool and we no longer pay for them. So what that's done is that it means that when we actually build out our structure is a flexible structure that basically adapts to the need. As more and more requests come in, we throw more and more machines into rotation to be able to go and handle this. And all of this process is done pretty much automatically. And so, you know, we do actually validate. We do get notifications to say that we're going past certain thresholds to be able to see what we're doing and have some human intervention capabilities there. But most of the process is done directly through load balancers and automatic provisioning. So it does provide us an amount of flexibility and a cost effectiveness that we couldn't have had 10 years ago because those services weren't available. Having these services available now means that we can actually use the compute power that we need when we need it and not have to pay for it when we don't need it. So that's actually revolutionized the way you actually build out these types of services. And many, you know, we're seeing more and more companies, more and more startups actually use this type of service to be able to go and do that. The key thing too is that what we've got is when we rely on these types of services, what we've got is a whole network operations team behind it, who's making sure that those machines are up and running, or if something goes wrong with them, that they get taken out of rotation and replaced by an equivalent machine to be able to pick up what actually fell off. In a more traditional means, we would have had to build out that team. We would have had to hire all those people ourselves. Here, we were able to focus on providing our solution rather than focusing on the infrastructure itself. The infrastructure is a commodity. The infrastructure is something I want to be able to plug into today, pretty much like I use electricity. I don't want to worry about who's got a generator down on a river not too far from me. I just want the electricity to come on when I turn the switch on. It's the same thing now with compute power. What we're seeing is the ability to go and think of the compute power not as being something that I build myself, but something that I switch on when I need it and switch off when I don't.
It's interesting, you know, earlier you talked about decision making based on analysis of data. And so what do you see as the state of research on computing tools to help make decisions based on the real-time analysis of data as it streams in?
Well, it's a very exciting field. I mean, there's a lot of research going on right now. Many, many interesting approaches. What's really interesting is the approach that we've taken is actually to go and look at this more as a signal processing type of approach. It's basically my signal is the stream of incoming data, and I want to be able to identify relevant elements happening in that signal. Okay? So basically, if you look at what we do, we actually have a two-phase approach. First of all, we filter the data to be able to find the relevant elements for the type of analysis we want to do. So filter by geolocation, filter by subject matter, so what we can identify with keywords or basic analysis of what the meaning of the element is coming in. Most of our successful elements are the ones that are actually based on keyword searches. Very, very simple statistical analysis on keyword searches actually bring back some very, very relevant information at a very low cost in terms of compute time. So we were actually fairly surprised by that. We took that approach just to see if we could actually get something that would give us a reasonable way of segmenting the data to be able to go and analyze it in streams that make sense. And what we found is that by doing it that way, first of all, the amount of compute time required to filter is very, very low. So it responds very, very quickly. And that if you use the law of large numbers, again, we're talking about statistics. We're talking about huge amounts of data coming in, which means that I don't need to get the full signal to be able to understand what its key characteristics are. I can actually go and take a subset of the signal to be able to do an analysis and pull it through. It's basically very similar to the techniques that you use when you're doing polling for elections. It's you can predict what the outcome of the U.S. presidential elections are with a couple of thousand of people being polled. Statistics will tell us what error we're committing when we do that, what the margin of error is, and it's actually pretty precise. And so by using these techniques to be able to go and filter down to fairly narrow streams that are relevant to the subject matter that we're looking at, you can be much more effective than by actually doing the full analysis going through. And the advantage is that given the volumes of data, it's statistically meaningful, which means that we can actually predict with a very, very small stream what an overall stream would actually be doing. So that helps us go and be able to predict very, very early without having to wait for all the compute to actually finish.
What do you see as the upcoming innovations in big data?
Well, I think we're just beginning to understand what we can do with it. It's been interesting to see. It's a trend. I mean, big data didn't just happen overnight. We've actually had more and more access to data. The key thing that's changed now is the public accessibility with networks like social media. And when I see things like movement towards open science where you'll see public research mandated to be accessible to everybody, you'll see the ability to get data streams that we didn't have access to before. Now, it's not a done deal yet. There's still a lot of hurdles to get over to be able to get all that data accessible in a meaningful way. But the data is becoming available, and that's really key change that I'm seeing. Having that data available means that we need to develop the tools, and there's a very, very active field of research to understand how we can actually do this. If you look at companies like Google who are investing massive amounts in terms of understanding how you can handle huge volumes of data in reasonable amounts of time to be able to go and help predict what you're actually doing, you find that there's been a lot of research in various fields, and all that research is now coming together to be able to do what we're calling now big data. It's not really new. It's been a trend that we've been seeing grow over the past decade or so. What we're really seeing now is the ability to go and, first of all, get access to the data, and that's the key point. There has been huge amounts of data available throughout the world. They just wasn't necessarily accessible to the people who could have done analysis on them. The second element is we've not only got access or getting access to those large volumes of data, we also have the compute power coming to be able to go and actually do the analysis that's required to be able to go and make sense of that data. And the third element that's actually coming in to go and tie this all together is the bandwidth capabilities that we're getting with our high-speed networks that are coming up. I mean, basically, I remember when I was happy having 1 megabit per second come in to my house, and I thought that was amazing. Today, I'd find that pitifully slow. And what we're seeing is we're seeing with technology such as fiber to the house be able to go and get huge volumes of data coming into your place of work to be able to go and do analysis that you couldn't have imagined doing before. So what we've got now is the confluence of three elements. First of all, the availability of large volumes of data. Secondly, the computational power to be able to make sense of it. And thirdly, the bandwidth to be able to get the data from one place to another so that you can actually handle it. And getting those three together is what's been enabling all the research that we've been seeing in very, very many labs throughout the world to be able to see, okay, how, you know, what are the right tools to be able to go and make sense of this in a meaningful way? We've known how to be able to go and do, you know, say, large analytics on huge data sets for a long time. You know, look at all the work that we've been doing in terms of doing weather prediction. Okay, if you think of the number of captors that are out there just capturing temperature and wind speed and all the other elements and being able to stream that to massive compute centers that try and do a fairly good job as to predicting what the weather will be, all that has been pushing elements to go through. Now, if you look at doing a weather simulation, that's one aspect where the problem is actually fairly well defined. We understand what, you know, what controls weather, what actually influences it, and the mathematics are pretty good about that. What we're now coming onto is more unstructured data. And again, if you look at Twitter with its examples of, you know, I've got 160 characters in which to go and express myself, and I've got to go and make sense of the data that's in those really, really short messages. What we found is the interesting thing is that what we get is a lot of very, very small elements of data to go and process. And being able to go and do that in a meaningful way and be able to extract sensible results from them, is where the major challenge has been. It's been trying to understand what does it mean? What are they actually talking about? To give you one little example of one of the things we do in TrendSpotter is we look for links. Now, the thing is, given the fact that you're using Twitter, your links typically won't be clear. They'll be shortened by some service. Now, if you're using some, you know, a shortener like Bitly rather than another shortener, you'll get different representations of the same data element. If you add in other aspects, such as all of the marketing tags that you'll get on your URLs, so basically to find that the source was Twitter or the source was Facebook or that it went through a given campaign. So data that's actually passed in the URL that is meaningless to the content you're pulling out but shows up in the string, which means you can't do a simple text compare to be able to see the two URLs are identical. You actually have to go and resolve them and put in algorithms that will actually go and tell you that these two URLs, despite the fact that they don't have the same characters in them, actually point to the same data element and should be the same. And that's one of the major efforts we actually did in ours, in our service, was to be able to go and identify that and be able to go and find out what the actual source was. And it's not perfect. There are some cases where we can't resolve, and it looks as if two URLs are different or that the content is different, and in fact, they're not. So a lot of the efforts have to do with understanding what's actually happening when you try and use very short text, so huge volumes of tweets, but very, very little content in each one, which means you can't do a very, very strong semantic analysis on them. There's not enough data to be able to pull. There's very little to actually work with, so it's being able to go and understand how to go and do that in a timely manner. Again, because one of the key things that we are trying to do is try and do this in a way where you're getting the results as soon as possible. That poses huge challenges and actually was research that we didn't think we would have to do when we first started doing this. It's as we started developing it and realizing that we were getting multiple reports on the same URL and understanding why we were getting those multiple reports is because the software couldn't figure out that they were the same URL. A human being could generally figure it out just by looking at it. So being able to go and develop the heuristics that would be able to go and figure out are two URLs the same, where it's not a simple text comparison. There's a lot more that goes into it to be able to go and do this properly. And, you know, are we 100% correct? No, we still have some things that filter through and that don't quite recognize, and we're constantly tuning it to make it better. It's part of what's actually involved here. But, you know, there's still so much more that needs to be done here. And if you look at where big data is going, it's we now have the ability to do it. Now what's coming in is a lot of research to be able to say, okay, We know that we've got this ability. What do we do with it? How do we analyze it? What's meaningful analysis? What are the types of math that are most applicable to be able to go and get the right responses back?
And it's interesting. You're talking about a number of processes and algorithms and, you know, sort of the engine behind all the technology that you put forward in Trendspotter. Do you have a patent, or are you going through a patent process?
We are going through a patent process. We don't currently have a patent yet. It's a long process.
Alan, you're considered one of the top thinkers in the world, and in fact, you were elected, and you're now the past president, immediate past president of the ACM, because of your long stature and success history worldwide in technology. So as a result, you're sort of the perfect person to ask these next two questions. The first one is, what do you see, based on all of this experience you have, as the top challenges facing the ICT industry in 2013?
For me, the major problem is a problem of education. It's what I find is that when I look to see where we're coming up with the next generation of computer scientists, where they come from, I don't see us training enough people with the proper skills to be able to go and meet the challenges. Just to give you an idea right now, is I can't think of any domain today that doesn't use computing intensely. Computing is now a tool that is used in every domain that you can think of. Yet, when I look at what type of training people are getting in terms of using computers to solve problems, I find that the training is much lower than I would expect. Because when you have a technology that is going to be used in every domain that you can think of, and going from everything, you know, for history, literature, engineering and science, obviously, but all the other domains now are using these tools to be able to go and do their research, to do their work. And what we need is more training. And very, very early on, I get frustrated when I see courses being given, you know, if they're being given at high school level, typically it'll be to teach you how to use word processors or Excel or something of the sort. That's not computer science. That's not, you know, what they're learning is specific tools that are a small subset of what you would need to master to be able to use the computer as effectively as you can, no matter what domain you're in. So I see the challenge as being education first and foremost. It's, you know, every study that I see in terms of the number of skilled professionals that we need to be able to fill in industry needs show me that we don't have them. We're not training enough of them. We don't have those skills being trained. And what I'd love to see is to see, say, computer science taught as a problem-solving approach. It's an approach that's been used at Harvey Mudd College and that I found very, very interesting. So my predecessor as ACM president, Maria Clave, is now president at Harvey Mudd College. And one of the things her team has put together there and that has impressed me completely is, first of all, they've taken the introductory computer science course, and rather than make it a course that will teach you how to program in a specific language or teach you a specific dialect, focuses on how to use a computer to solve problems. So it's a very, very different approach. That's one aspect of what they've done. The second aspect is that they've made that course mandatory across all the disciplines, whether it's history, literature, no matter what, you will take this introductory computer science course to be able to understand how to use the computer yourself to be able to solve your own problems. And it's had some amazing effects in terms of what it's done. Now, again, this is one college. The results are early, but you see what extending the notion of training people to understand how to use computing as a tool, to use computing as a way to solve problems, because that's what computers are for, and that's where the big challenge is getting people to understand that it's not just Excel, it's not just Word, it's not just email. It's all about solving problems, and if you relegate the ability to solving problems to a small subset of people who have been explicitly trained to how to do it, so your IT professionals who are the only ones who actually know how to go and do this, what you're done is you're failing completely, because you're not getting the maximum output that you could get from using these tools. So I see the big challenge as, how do we spread the knowledge? How do we spread this know-how? How do we make it so that people in every discipline understand how to use these tools to their maximum effect, no matter what they do? Because I feel that that's where the challenge is going to be. You know, today, you can't do anything without having a computer in it. Your cell phone is a computer. Your hotel lock on your door is a computer. It's Computers are everywhere, but the training to be able to understand how to go and use them isn't widespread, and that's where I see the major challenge.
I guess on the opposite side of the coin is, outside of challenges, then what do you see as the top opportunities for the ICT industry in 2013?
I don't see any limits there at all. I look at this field, a field that I've been working in for over 30 years now, and I see how it's evolved and what we're, able to do. I look and I see that the phone that I carry in my pocket has more compute power than the biggest supercomputer available in the world when I was a graduate student. And I carry that in my pocket. And I use it to make phone calls. I also use it to go and navigate maps. And I also use it to get full graphics on it. I can even watch movies on it. You look at how this has evolved and what's available to us. I think we're only scratching the surface of what we can do with it. There's so much more that we can start doing with these devices as they become more widespread. Already, when you look at how things have changed just with the notion of having smartphones, and this is, again, over the past 10 years, think of what your cell phone was 10 years ago. And think of what it is today. You don't interact with it the same way. You don't just use it for phone, for calling people. It's one of the services that it provides, but it's not the only one. I use my cell phone to control the lights in my house. I use my cell phone to control my stereo system. It's become my gateway to the world, to everything that I can do. It's become my communications device. I was explaining this to a group of students out a couple of weeks back. And I just made the reference to Star Trek at that point, and it really made me think of, do you remember the original Star Trek series and the communicators that they had there and what you could do with them? And the fact that you can use this as a way to integrate all the services that you've got offers up so many capabilities. We're just scratching the surface right now. We haven't even done half of what we could be doing when we look at what the opportunities are. It's an amazing time to be in this field. Because there's just so much available out there and so much to do.
Again, with your tremendous background as really one of the world's acknowledged experts, what do you see as some of the major computing areas, specialties, or domains having the highest growth rates, and why?
Trying to think in terms of the highest growth rate or the highest impact. So in terms of growth rate right now, I think everything that we're doing in terms of natural language processing, understanding how people talk, how people communicate, is probably one of the ones that's nearing maturity and getting to a point where we're starting to do things that are actually pretty amazing in terms of what we could imagine before. See a lot of effort going into that, trying to understand how you communicate more naturally with your devices to be able to get them to do what you need them to do. If I look at things like, take Apple Siri or the equivalent on Android, to be able to go and talk to your device to let it do what it is you want to have done becomes an easier way to go and get things done, especially if you're in something like your car. I'd love to be able to go and say, I need to make a phone call. Rather than typing the number in on the console in my car, I'd love to be able to just go and say, call Peggy and let her know that I'm going to be late for my appointment, and have the system be able to understand, who of the Peggy's I know is the most probable one that I was referring to, find that person's number and get them a message in a way that is most appropriate. So see if they're online, see if they're available on their phone. Do we know if they're there or not? Have they put up an away message? And be able to figure out how to get that message to them. We're seeing some interesting steps now, but you can see these are baby steps. We're not only at the very, very beginning of it. It's, as you start using it, you see, it's interesting, but there's still much more research that needs to be done there to be able to get it to be at a level of understanding where you wouldn't have to think about how you go and tell the computer what you want it to do. Because right now, with all the systems that I've seen, that I've tried out there, you pretty much have to go and follow a certain syntax, a certain structure of your commands to be able to go and get that understanding to happen. So you're forcing the end user to be able to go and use basically a dialect that is specific to the tool that you want to use. Where I see much more happening is now being able to get to place where there is an actual internal representation of what the meaning of what you're trying to do is, be able to extract that data and get to a place where it just becomes easier to get things done without having to go and type in arcane commands or click on specific buttons or do things where we're forcing humans to adapt to the computer's way of communicating rather than doing it the other way around. It's where I see the biggest growth is getting to the point where computers will adapt to how humans communicate. That's where there's still huge amounts of work to be done there, and we're getting there. We're getting close. We're getting to systems that are actually pretty meaningful. There was an interesting tool that I saw demonstrated by Microsoft's research, where it was a virtual being that would play with you and interact with you. And it was actually pretty amazing, the sense of personality that you could go and attach to that virtual being based on how it would pick up cues as to what you were doing. Now, they were using all the technology available in the Microsoft environment with the Kinect to be able to see what your body movement was, be able to go and do the natural language processing in terms of capturing your voice and understanding what was there. But again, you could see the beginnings of something where, with a bit more research, with a bit more effort, we could get to a place where your computer becomes your virtual assistant in a much more meaningful way than it is today. Today, again, I have to go and adapt my behavior to be able to get my computer to do what I need it to do. What I'm looking at is all the things that we could do to make the computer adapt to my behavior, to understand what I want it to do. And that's a massive change. And we're getting there. You know, that's where I see the biggest opportunities right now.
And earlier I indicated that you were the president of the ACM and now the immediate past president. You still sit on the executive committee because of this leadership role, the ACM being the world's largest educational scientific professional association, you know, really well known for its Turing Awards, which is the Nobel Prize of Computing, SIG Graph, of which you were also the past president, which is sort of the world's largest graphics association, but also associated with the ACM. So you've been in this great sort of position to look at what's happening, governments around the world and industry around the world and also in academia. From that perspective of leadership, what policies need to be implemented to foster innovation?
Well, the key policies that I would see is actual more financing of public research. And research isn't free. It takes a lot of effort to be able to go and get meaningful research, especially when you start looking at subjects like supercomputing, where to be able to go and push the envelope of current computing capabilities, you need to be putting thousands of individual computing elements together to be able to go and participate in a much larger scope. And that doesn't come for free. So they're being able to go and have policies that favor research, that favor innovation, that push to make public labs do as much as they can and make sure that they have the ability to do their research. That's where I see the biggest elements that need to happen. The second element is more related to the point that I brought up earlier, which has to do with education. Again, education is key in this. Right now, I don't believe that we're educating enough people to the possibilities of computing. And that's, again, across all disciplines. I would favor making sure that every child gets a problem-solving with computers course, something to teach them how to go and use computers as a way to get their day-to-day tasks done, understanding what the capabilities of these tools are, so that they can be more effective in their professional lives as they move forward. There's, you know, that doesn't happen without key public policy initiatives to make sure that the orientation of education around these technologies is actually happening. The worst thing we could do is not train people, is not give them the education to continue developing this technology with a small subset of people actually able to use the technology in a meaningful way. That's what we need to avoid at all costs.
Alan, in your history, you are a very, very successful entrepreneur and innovator. And in fact, you led teams that created graphic software, which had the lion's share of the worldwide market. You also led teams in terms of graphics, implementing graphics technology that won an Academy Award. And you've started a series or been co-founder of a series of companies, again, with innovating technologies. From that perspective, as a very successful entrepreneur, what are your best practices for startups?
Oof. The best practices for startups is to aim as high as you can. It really is. Don't ever consider that anything's impossible. Don't think that you can't do things. Always look and see, okay, how can I go and solve this problem? Find an interesting problem and dig into it, work at it, solve it, get it to a point where you can actually wrangle it and bring it to a manageable state. The key thing is to go and see there's a wealth of problems that need solving at any point in time. And what I've always found interesting in my career is that the opportunities that I've found and have decided to invest my time in have basically been challenges where I felt personally motivated to get the specific problem that we were looking at solved. There was a big challenge. There was something to look at. If I look at Trendspotters, or say my most recent one, the challenge was there to say, okay, there's this wealth of data, but I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to make sense of it. And that one I saw as a personal challenge, something that would wake me up at night thinking about how would I actually solve this? How, you know, what can I use in terms of the panoply of tools that I've got at my disposal? I mean, I did my training in math, not in computer science. I focused on computer science for my graduate studies towards the end of my career, but my original studies were actually in math. And so I look at all the tools that I learned in math to be able to go and solve problems in an abstract manner and see how I can apply them to the real world problems that I encounter. And that's really where you look at things. You say, okay, what do I know? What are my skills? What am I good at? What can I bring to bear to change things? How can I use my skills to be able to solve a real world problem? And the key thing is to understand what problem you're solving. Don't get distracted by other things. Focus is really the key thing. You don't want to be looking in too many directions. You really want to get a problem that you understand, that you can scope out and say, this is the problem I'm solving. And if you can't explain it to somebody in, you know, say 30 seconds, you're probably looking at too much. You really want to get it down to a point where you understand what the problem is that you're trying to solve, and you're focusing all of your energies on it, and you're not getting distracted by other things. So to give you an example of how this applies, to say Trendspotter, where I pointed out that the key thing that we focused on was actually getting the math right to be able to go and identify key elements that were trending very, very early on. We didn't focus on building out the network infrastructure. We didn't focus on building out a data center. We didn't focus on things that weren't elements where we brought significant value and change. We hired those out. We went and basically rented time out on available systems for renting compute time. Why? Because it was much more important for us, again, a very small team when you're starting out, is don't get lost in other elements. Pay what it takes to get the best services where you can get them for things that are commodities. Again, compute time is a commodity today. You shouldn't be designing the architecture of your network. Somebody else can do a better job of it and can probably do a better job of maintaining it for you. Where you should focus on is on where you're making a difference, what value you're adding, and what you're actually bringing to the table for your clients. See, what problem am I solving? Making sure that 100% of your effort is going towards solving that problem. If you can keep that type of drive, you can keep that type of focus on it, you make successful companies. This is how we've been doing things. I mean, yeah, if I look back, you mentioned the work in graphics. When we focused on Maya at the time, so this was the development of the Maya software package, oh, this was, what, 15 years ago. The problem that we had was that the domain was changing so quickly that any architecture you could come up with would probably be outdated by the time you shipped it. So we looked at the problem from that point of view and decided to design an architecture that could change. So we designed an element that was basically a framework for plugging in new modules, and the whole design was from the get-go set up to say, we don't know what graphics will be in 10 years. And again, 10 years ago, we didn't know. But what we do know is that if we design this architecture properly, we'll be able to adapt and put in whatever we need to be able to solve those problems once the technology becomes available and once we actually get new elements. And the fact that we focus Maya on its architecture and making it flexible, making it adaptable, and understanding that the one thing we knew was that we didn't know where we would be 10 years out. And if you think 10 years in computing is a huge amount of time. If you think back 10 years ago and imagine that you would carry something like a smartphone, one of today's smartphones, with full HD video capabilities, with full communications capabilities, at bandwidths that you couldn't even imagine on landlines at the time. You're talking about a whole paradigm shift in terms of what you would do. So what we were designing was designing for a future that we couldn't foresee. All we knew was that it would happen faster than we could do it, that we knew that it would change, that there would be technologies that would come as research developed that would be much better than anything we could possibly imagine, and our challenge was to design an architecture that could work within that framework and adapt. And to give you an idea, within the team, we had set ourselves two objectives. The first objective when we designed Maya was to say, it will be the number one product within 6 months of shipping. We made that goal, but we also had a second goal, which was set by our CEO, Rob Burgess, at the time. He said, you basically have to design this, not only so that it becomes the number one selling product straight out the door, but that it maintains that position for the next 10 years. It's been 15 years now, and it still has that position. And that was because we were very, very clear on what the goal of the architecture we were designing was. We took a hit in terms of the time it took us to develop Maya, when as we looked at this 10-year goal, one of the questions we asked ourselves was, well, do we know what the computer will actually be 10 years from now? At the time, we were developing for Silicon Graphics, because that was the computer that you would use to do graphics. And one of the choices we could have made was to actually intimately tie it to the operating system of the Silicon Graphics machine. Given the fact that we couldn't know that SGI would continue to be the dominant player at that time, you know, we couldn't look into our crystal balls and say 10 years from now it will still be. We made a conscious choice to write the code on an abstract operating system level so that we made no assumptions as to what the underlying operating system would be. What that allowed us to do is within 6 months of actually shipping the first version of the product, we also shipped a Windows version. And then we followed up with a Mac version. And then we followed up with a Linux version. We were able to do that because of the early design goals that were based on having very clear notions of what we were building and why we were building it. Doing that and defining that up front really makes a difference in the success of what you try and do.
Alan, this is a really sort of major problem for many startups, and that is fundraising. Now, you've been through this process many times. What are your secrets to fundraising?
Well, it's basically look at what do you really need and what do you need it for. So to give you an idea, right now, we're only just going into our fundraising for Trendspotter right now. We didn't need funding. Why? It's because we actually built things where we were able to self-fund our development effort for the first 2 years of the company. It's we've been able to go and build up enough traction in terms of what we do to bring in enough money to pay for the services that we're actually using. And again, one of the key abilities to do this comes from the fact that we can use things like Amazon Web Services or Google Services to be able to go and rent time when we need it. That means that you can design your service to pay for itself, or as close as possible to that. That means that the ramp-up time and the amount of money that you need that, say, in startups, say, 10 years ago, you couldn't do this. You needed that initial capital injection to be able to go and get the ability to set up your data center, to be able to go and build out this infrastructure that you had to design for peak. Because if you were, say, very successful and you needed twice as many computers as you already had, you're talking about weeks of delays before you can actually order them, get them into your data center, assuming that you actually had the space in your data center to physically put them. Just a lot of issues that you had to go and take into account that you don't today. So fundraising has now become an issue that is less of an issue than it was before. It means that you don't need as much funding to get started as you did, say, 10 years ago. The reason for that is the ability to go and actually rent the time you need. There are very few cases that I can see for a startup to actually own their own machines. You should be renting. You should be actually using services that let you use compute on the fly and scale up as you need it. To give you an idea, this here, as we're going through with Trendspotter, we can actually ramp it up within 5 minutes to get double the capacity without any problem. It's that simple. The services are there. They favor innovation. That means that companies that couldn't have gotten started years ago can today. You can try things out. The initial investment isn't all that huge. If you happen to have a bit of savings on the side, you can actually self-fund to get started. Do your proof of concept, get an understanding of what it is, build out a customer base, set partnerships with major companies, and then look for investment afterwards when you need to grow. That's what I think is much more interesting today. And again, the technologies have changed so much that now this is, well, it's not just the technology, it's the services that are available. I mean, the technology was there to be able to do this before, but it took something like Amazon Web Services to come out and give users the ability to try things out. I mean, I see certain universities not far from me are actually not investing in supercomputing capabilities or Hadoop clusters anymore because it's just much more cost efficient to actually get the students to just rent time on commercially available Hadoop clusters as they need them. And then when you don't need them anymore, you stop paying for them, which means that the cost of doing it is much more in tune with the actual work that you're doing. So that's changed the way you actually build companies. And that's a major change. It makes a big difference in terms of how you can actually start up. And for me, I see this as a really, really positive thing, because what it means is that all sorts of small teams can start out, test an idea with very little upfront investment. If you find that you can't solve the problem after several months worth of investing, you know, on the order of hundreds of dollars a month of compute time, you probably want to say, well, maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all. But if you can do that for a fairly small investment and you see that you now have a product that actually works, that you can start pitching to clients, that you can actually start scaling and selling, now you've got something that lets you kickstart all of your projects much, much easier with much less requirements for initial cash, because you don't have that initial capital investment required to be able to build out your computing capabilities. The ability to rent is a game changer in terms of what this means for startups.
So now, as an add-on to this sort of question about startups and then fundraising is, and you have these qualities, so what qualities make for a successful innovator?
Let me see. Say no fear of the unknown, I think is probably the, you know, the key thing is, you know, being able to take risks is important. It's understanding that you are taking a risk and being able to go and quantify how you actually go about it, making sure that you've got your bases covered in terms of what you're trying to do. Passion is really what it's all about. It's, you know, if you're not passionate about what you're doing, you shouldn't be starting up a company. I mean, it takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of work. If you enjoy what you're doing and you have fun doing it, it's an amazing experience, especially as you start getting successes and you see your client feedback coming in, telling you what they're doing with it. And when you see your clients start doing things with your services that you never imagined they do, then you start saying, okay, well, we're solving much more of a problem than we actually thought we would. So I think it's passion, yes, fearless, absolutely. It's drive. You've really got to go and work at it. It's hard work. It takes a lot of effort. You don't, you know, if you're not willing to put in the hours, you probably shouldn't be doing a startup. It really is about understanding why you're doing what you're doing, being passionate about it, and being able to go stick to it, because the first couple of months are going to be hard no matter what you do. And getting the word out, being able to go and explain it to people, showing folks what it is you're doing, especially when it's a new concept, something that people don't have a reference to. It's, I mean, to give you an idea, we have a TrendSpotter. A lot of our time has been spent explaining the difference between traditional data analytics and real-time predictive analytics, what the difference is and being able to show it. And what we found is that by telling stories, explaining to people what it is we do that's different, that they couldn't do with the more traditional methods. The traditional methods are important. You know, you need to have good data analytics to understand how well your business is doing. So I'm not saying that we do things better than the traditional elements. What we're doing is something different. And trying to get people to understand what the difference is really key. Because to be successful, you've got to, first of all, get people to understand why you're different, what you're doing that's new, and what the value is to them. When you can get that down to simple stories that you can tell, where you can explain to people examples of what they can do with this, then you get an exciting framework in which to build up your startup and to get successful.
We have this golden opportunity to tap the genius of one of the top innovators in the world. And around us, what do we see? A lot of noise, so much information, spam in a sense. So kind of looking at how you filter things in from a cognitive standpoint, what are the top resources that you use that you would recommend that would be of value to our audience?
Well, the interesting thing is I actually eat my own dog food. And right now, I use TrendSpotter a lot. Basically, I've set up filters for the elements that I'm most interested in. I'm interested in data analytics. I'm interested in big data. I'm interested in how people actually use social media. So I'm following all those topics with my own tools. What that does is it lets me know when something interesting is happening to be able to pull that information out. Now, the interesting thing is what I do with that is I then post it on my various social media channels. And what it's turned out for me is that the one that's most interesting turns out to be Facebook, which I didn't expect. I thought it would be more LinkedIn because of its more professional aspect. But what I find is I get more conversations happening on Facebook in terms of people actually commenting on what I'm posting and sharing. And the most interesting thing that I find is that by driving information out, by finding interesting topics and sharing them with my followers, what I get is I get a lot of feedback from them in terms of when they spot something that might be of interest to me, the social aspects of this are kicking in, where now I have people spontaneously sending me links to articles that they found that might be of interest to me because they've seen what I post about and what I'm interested in. So getting that out and building that out where I'm, you know, if I look at the people I know, okay, many of them are, you know, computer scientists, research scientists, working in many of the major labs. So there is also the community that I built up, the people I've met over the years of my career. But when you build up that network of people who now are acting as your sieve, are looking for information and making the link and said, oh, this is something that I might be interested in, and spontaneously sending it to me. So now what I've done is I've extended my automated tools, so which I use TrendSpotter for, with my social network, where I now have over 2,000 people who are actively looking for content for me. And that's amazing, because what I'm getting is the interesting parts of what this group of very bright and, you know, essentially mostly techies, geeks, folks who are in similar fields who are actually doing it, that tends to be people who I tend to be having the most interactions with, when they spot something that they know I'm interested in, will send it to me. And that's something where it doesn't need to be popular. What TrendSpotter will find is things that will appeal to the most people, which aren't necessarily the most interesting to me or the most relevant to what I'm trying to do. The field I may be looking at may be so tight and so, you know, so restricted that it may not show up as a trend anywhere. But people who do know about it, who are, say, actively doing research in a field, when they see something that they know I'm doing research in, will let me know about it. So I'm getting this extra level of notification from the researchers that I work with. And it's a two-way street. It's because they see that I am always posting things that they consider to be interesting, then they feel that it's interesting and adequate to return the favor. And when they see something that I might be interested in, let me know. So that's really where I look. Of course, I read all the major trade journals. I read a lot of the research papers for the conferences that cover the topics that I'm most interested in. But now that's actually been complemented by a lot of work in social media, just as an early warning system, as a way of finding if there's something going on where I'm using this massive volume of information that's being traded every day and exchanged by people who are passionate about what they're posting. That lets me go and find topics that I wouldn't otherwise find.
Now, it's interesting. You got this company you founded, TrendSpotter, which uses this world-leading technology. You're able to mine all sorts of trends that are coming up. You're intimately involved with social media, and again, you're conversing with your followers and others beyond. Are there areas of controversy that have interest to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, anything to do with look at subjects of open access, trying to see what the role of publishers should be today, and again, trying to see where we're going. There's a movement afoot in terms of looking to see how public research results should be accessible. What about what happens when, say, in a subject like pharma, where you look at what the companies who are doing their research, there's a movement now to try and get that data out there so that everybody can have access to it and understand what it means, be able to do the analytics on that. Cory Doctorow from Boing Boing posted a really interesting piece a couple of weeks ago pushing for this open access. Now, while I don't agree with everything that Cory says, it was a very, very interesting piece in terms of explaining the philosophical reasoning behind it, what he's trying to do there. We're also seeing things like what we do with things like paywalls. If you look, so one of the key issues that we've had at the ACM is looking at our digital library. Maintaining a digital library, so the ACM has the largest collection of computing-related papers in the world, and that's our ACM digital library. Typically, most of the research centers actually have access for their staff and students to be able to get to it, but individuals would have to go and pay for access to the content. We give you all the search capabilities, but the full text is a paying service. What we've had is a long discussion within ACM to see what our role as a computing society should be and what we do as a scientific organization, and felt that what we should be doing is removing as many of the barriers as possible. So one of the things we've done is to make it so that it becomes the author's choice. We've set up a structure where the author of a paper can decide to make the access to their content freely available to the world. So no paywall, nothing at all. What we do is we give them a link that they can set up on their website that goes and gets you the full text of the paper that they wrote without requiring a fee. And that's been amazing in terms of the feedback we've gotten on that. And those are the types of things that we're experimenting with. We're trying to see how can we do this in a way that makes sense, where we can ensure that the service that we provide continues to be provided in the future. Because, you know, the key thing is what you want with a library is a repository of the content that's been published with a guarantee that that content will always be accessible. And that's where the challenge lies, is how do you finance it? So we've been working with various models and looking at that. And that's one of the things I'm particularly passionate about, is understanding how we can do more in making as much of the scientific content that we publish accessible to as much of the world as possible.
Earlier in our discussion, you talked about the importance of teaching computer science in all domains, and you gave many, many reasons for that. You also shared your experiences at Harvey Mudd, and you talked about the fact that they have a very innovative system for engaging students into computer science. And now you sit on the board of, or advisory board of Harvey Mudd, which is one of the top engineering schools in the U.S. Are there additional experiences that you could share, or success stories that you can share with regards to Harvey Mudd?
Well, yeah, in terms of Harvey Mudd, and what, you know, one of the interesting things that's come because of this change, there have been two elements that are actually very, very noteworthy. First of all, what's happening is there is a pretty large increase in terms of the number of students now signing up to major in computer science. The interesting thing is that these students don't come from your traditional STEM backgrounds. So you're getting a wide variety of students coming in, bringing in their own way of looking at problem solving. You're getting historians in there. You're getting people who studied literature. You're getting people who are looking at broad domains of knowledge and expanding what we do with computers, because that's what they're passionate about. And that's, for me, is very, very interesting, is when you can start getting computing out of the realm of pure engineering and technology and start thinking in terms of in the broader realm of solving problems, because that's really what it's all about. That's what we do. And getting that message across is actually difficult, because most of the people who are making decisions on this, so say your typical, you know, politicians voting on an education budget, will look at that and immediately say computing is for sending rockets to the moon, okay, or whatever technical problem you may be thinking of, and aren't necessarily thinking in terms of the broader sense of what computing can do, in terms of actually doing problem solving, doing data analysis, being able to make sense of huge volumes of data and presenting it in a way that a human can understand. Getting that to happen is important. And the way you do that is by bringing people who are experts in fields other than the purely technical fields to be able to start looking at how do we push computing in the directions where it solves more, say, a wider variety of problems, so we can see that. The other aspect that has been absolutely amazing at Harvey Mudd, and this I attribute to the change in the way that computer science is taught, is that the number of women who are enrolling in computing is, I believe, now 47%, compared to national average in the States that's, you know, either in the single digits or in the low teens, okay, depending on which school you're at. This is very rare. What you're actually seeing is that typically what happens is computer science gets relegated to a stereotype of the, you know, student who would sign up for it. You start thinking about it, and you're thinking about your video gaming male geek. That's who your stereotypical computer scientist is. That's not true at Harvey Mudd. At Harvey Mudd, what you're seeing is, again, wide variety of backgrounds. And this is great for innovation, because what it does is it brings different problems, different approaches to solving problems, different aspects as to what's important into the equation. And it gets people to think about the problems they're solving in a totally different manner than if you had a very, very homogeneous set of people actually working in it. So getting that confrontation of ideas, getting those different viewpoints is important, and especially getting women in is hugely important. When, you know, I mentioned earlier that one of the things we're seeing is that we're not training enough people in computing right now. I think, you know, one easy way to do it is make it so that it's popular with women. Right now, if you look in your typical computer science courses, you'll find it's essentially males. And there's, you could double the number just by making sure that you had women in there. It's, if we design our courses so that we make it look as if computer science is something that may not be attractive to them, that isn't something that they should be doing. If we reinforce the message so that everything that you see in terms of representing computer scientists in the media, you know, if I look at the movies, what do you see? It's typically, if you've got a computer scientist, the guy with thick glasses and no social skills, and you see the typical nerd stereotype. It doesn't have to be that way. And again, a lot of it has to do with how we present it, what we focus on as the goal for computing. If we focus on problem solving, and again, you know, this has been for me a very, very interesting thing, seeing how well it's working at Harvey Mudd, is seeing that the very fact that you describe what you do differently changes the people who you will be attracted to. And that's really where we need to be looking at. It's to understand what computing is for and what you can do with it, and understanding that it has a wide variety of applications. And the, you know, pure engineering, pure technology elements aren't the only aspects of computing. There's so much more we can do with it. And if we can make that evident, if we can put that forward, I believe that the experience we've seen at Harvey Mudd should generalize.
So these next two questions are regarding the ACM, and I'll just give it a little bit of background from memory, and that is, the ACM is the Association for Computing Machinery. It is the world's largest and foremost educational scientific professional association, well known for their Turing Awards, which is the Nobel Prize of Computing, their Learning Center, and SIGs, or Special Interest Groups, such as SIGGRAPH. And other sort of facts associated with the ACM, and you talked about this earlier, is that they have the largest repository or digital library in the world, with something like 1.5 million subscribers. There's over 700 chapters around the world. They have something like 500 or over 500 conferences and workshops, over 70, something like 78 publications and newsletters. Really just a whole plethora of many benefits that can be found, and having that substantial influence on the world in terms of science, education, scientific research, and so on in the computing area. Now, you have a really significant position in that you are the immediate past president of the ACM. You sit on the council. Because of that role, you served as president. And you were also president of SIGGRAPH, and SIGGRAPH is world famous for innovation and for their conferences and so on. From that standpoint, from this position that you've had, can you talk about the internationalization of the ACM, this Association of Computing Machinery, how that is progressing and why this is important?
Well, actually, it's progressing extremely well. When I first joined the ACM almost 30 years ago, the standing joke was that the A in ACM stood for American. Now, to understand, I'm a French citizen, and at the time I lived in Paris, and volunteering and working within ACM was actually fairly difficult, given that most of the activity was actually centered around North America. So for me, this has been a personal goal as an ACM volunteer from very, very early on. What I wanted the organization to be is an organization that would focus as much on activities outside of North America as it did activities within North America. And this has been an ongoing effort for, easily 20 years now, in terms of how much we've been doing, what our focuses have been doing. The first steps that we did was to encourage the conferences that we hold to be held outside of North America. It's not always easy. It demands a fair amount of work, especially if all of your paperwork, all of the support is focused on American taxation rules and other such elements where, you know, people can feel comfortable with a certain way of doing things in one country that aren't necessarily the way you do them in others. So that's been a bit of education and inciting our SIGs especially to actually hold conferences outside of North America. And that's actually been very successful. That was the first step. What we then found was that as we were doing this, what we were getting back from our membership was that we didn't have enough regional focus on the differences that may be happening in different parts of the world, where the needs for a computer scientist in North America may not be exactly the same as the needs of a computer scientist in Europe, may not be the same as a computer scientist in China, which may not be the same as a computer scientist in India. Each region has its own particular flavor, its own particular laws that they need to comply with, and to, you know, to be able to go and fit in with a research framework that actually differs in various geographic areas. So something that we put in place about 6-7 years ago was to set up a notion of regional councils. So we set up three councils to start this off, one in China, one in India, and one in Europe. And we're looking to expand that now to other regions of the world as we find geographic areas that make sense as a unit where there is enough commonality to justify having a regional approach to doing things. Now, what these councils do is to actually go and focus on the needs of the ACM membership in their region and help us better meet those needs. So say when we look at the council in China, one of the things we're doing is translating certain of our key articles from English, which is the language that we publish most of our content in, to Chinese and making sure that that's accessible for people who may not have the level of English that you would expect to be able to go and comfortably read content that we're publishing in our magazines, for instance. Other aspects that we're doing is trying to see what it takes to be able to go and host conferences more effectively in given regions. So if you look at doing things in India, where there's a wealth of activity going on right now in terms of doing workshops and focused conferences specifically for the region to be able to better meet the needs of computer professionals in the area. In Europe, we're working with the European Council to see what makes sense in terms of, say, political locality across the European Union to be able to go and help better promote research efforts in computing within the region. And working with Informatics Europe, which is a local not-for-profit organization that focuses on research in computing in Europe, to see how we work better together to be able to go and help our members get better services in those areas. What we've seen over the past few years is that the major growth in membership at ACM, and just as a little point in fact, we first crossed the milestone of 100,000 members worldwide last year. So that was a major milestone, and most of that growth came from the efforts in our councils. It was our regional councils actually actively promoting ACM membership to people who may not have been as aware as they could have been of the activities of the ACM, to understand all of the conferences and workshops that we host, as you mentioned, be able to talk about all the magazines and, you know, technical journals that we actually publish. So we have 50 technical journals and about 30 magazines that are more focused on what the SIGs specifically are doing. So quite a lot of activity out there that isn't necessarily as well known outside of North America as it is here. So what we've been seeing is all the growth in terms of membership numbers. Our membership numbers in North America are fairly stable. They're growing a little bit, but nothing to write home about. What we're seeing the major growth take place is in the regions, is to see what's actually happening outside of North America. And that has been essentially due to the fact that we've been now actively promoting that we're visible in those regions where people can actually see, oh, there is an ACM Europe Council and this is what it's doing. And here's where I can call them and here's who I can talk to about it to see what's happening in my area around ACM. So that's been actually very, very valuable. It's been a great experience to see that because, you know, when I first joined ACM, as I was saying, I was talking about the running joke, nobody would have imagined that the president of the ACM could ever be a citizen from a country outside of North America. I mean, we could tolerate a Canadian, but we would never imagined anything other than an American or Canadian. And now I was the third non-American president of the ACM. My predecessor was Dame Wendy Hall from Great Britain. And to see that it's happening. Also, what we're seeing is that if I look at the ACM Executive Committee today, the structure of the Executive Committee has 3 out of 5 members of the Executive Committee reside outside the United States. So we've done that. We've now become the international organization that we hoped to be. There's still more work to be done to be able to go and continue to increase our activities outside of North America. And North America is still a key focus for what we do, but we now have the structures in place to be able to deliver on that promise and be able to do it effectively. So I'm very excited about that because this is what I was hoping to do in terms of getting the ACM to become more international when I first joined. I never imagined when I first joined that I would ever get elected president, so that was actually a big surprise when it ended up happening. But what I saw happen over these past 30 years is to see the organization go from stating that it wanted to be an international presence, to putting the structures in place in terms of supporting conferences outside of North America, to then going to a structural change where we actually put in to place these regional councils that fully support membership outside of the United States and Canada. So that's been, for me, a very, very exciting process to watch and to have been a part of.
You know, our audience out there is listening to this, and for some of them, maybe the ACM is something new. And so I would encourage them to do a search on the ACM using any one of the browser tools out there, or the ACM Learning Center, where the audience will see a plethora of benefits, things like mentoring and access to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books and courses and videos and tutorials and so on. So just a very rich environment for the individual practitioner out there who wants to get engaged, or the researcher. And of course, we talked about the digital library. Earlier, you mentioned that there's something like over 100,000. I think it's probably close to about 110,000 members. Again, the world's largest association. In addition to that, there's 36 special interest groups, which focus on particular domains within the sort of the broader computer science area or computing area. So, Alain, again, from your perspective, why should professionals join the ACM?
Well, if you look at our field, one of the things that you see is that it's a field that's always in a state of change. You look at what the popular tools are out there. If you're a computing professional, they're not the same tools as the ones you learned when you were doing your studies, unless you just graduated. It's a rate of change that I don't think we've ever seen in any other sector in the history of mankind. We are in constant flux. And one of the key challenges to being a successful computing professional is that you have to keep on learning. You have to go and hone your skills. You have to go and research the latest technologies because they change that fast. When, you know, we talk about all of the elements out there, I mean, what we see in computing is that 5 years in the computing profession is considered to be an eternity, meaning that you can't predict what the state of technology will be 5 years from now. Nobody can. We are constantly surprised. There's constant level of innovation, constant level of change coming, which means that to be successful, you have to keep up. You have to keep on learning. And that's really one of the things I love about this field, is because I love learning. I love finding out about new technologies, reading up on them, understanding what I could do with them, and being a part of an organization that helps its members stay abreast of this technology by publishing all of the content that we do, by making available all these courses. We're now setting up a series of webinars where members can sign up to learn about new technologies, you know, find out what's happening in the domain of recommendation engines, which is one of the most recent ones that we actually did. So lots of things that you can find out about explained by the people who actually did the research and discovered these technologies. So you're getting the top level of people who are presenting this. These are the people who actually invented the technology, are explaining in terms that are accessible to any professional who wants to go and stay abreast of this, understanding what's important, what the key changes are, and what it means to be able to go and make professional decisions. That's essential in our field. And what I think we're seeing is that we're seeing it as computing professionals because we focus on computing as an element. I think it generalizes to the whole population that one of the key things that will have to change is that people will have to have the ability to continue learning throughout their careers. The technology is still changing at a rate that is always increasing. We're not slowing down anytime soon. So the key thing is to be able to go and understand what's actually happening out there. You have to go and continue training. You have to continue learning about this. And having an organization like the ACM is essential for doing that, because this is a place where we can vet the content. We can find the best papers. We can recommend the best courses, the best textbooks, to be able to read up on it, depending on what it is you want to learn and what it is you want to focus on. There's so much content available out there. What we need is an organization like the ACM to be able to go and find it and be able to get a group of passionate volunteers because ACM is a volunteer-run organization. We actually go out and get people to review papers to be able to go and do all the peer review that's behind the scenes in terms of selecting the best content and making sure that this is what gets published in the various journals and conferences. Doing that is an essential function for the advancement of this field. And it's an essential thing for any professional in this field to do is to stay abreast of what's going on. So that's, you know, one what I would sum up as being the key element of what ACM is all about. It's centralizing the relevant content so that computing professionals can stay abreast with all of the changes that are happening in our field.
You know, it's really interesting you're mentioning relevant content. I mean, there's a series of a few videos upcoming, which are from the world's leading experts in the hottest areas. You talked about webinars, and there was one on recommender systems, but there's also now available, they're archived, that, for example, on mobility or security. Again, some of the top hot topics in the world, including big data, and from the top experts in the world. And you also mentioned curated content. That is, there's so much information out there. What is the best stuff? What should a researcher or a practitioner, what should they be looking at? With sort of the best out of the millions of pieces of information out there, there's things called tech packs. That's what they are. They're a curated sort of content of what's the best in a particular area like security or mobility or areas like enterprise architecture. So a lot of benefits that you're talking about. We're down now to our last couple of questions. You know, it's interesting looking at your background. You actually studied Mandarin, which I found just fascinating. And of course, you're an acknowledged world expert and a leader and an entrepreneur and an innovator and a scientist. So from all of your extensive speaking, travels, and work, do you have any interesting stories to share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Oh, boy. I think lots, actually. Trying to see. Well, the interesting thing was when I was in China recently, when I went for my first talk there where we were discussing how we could actually set up a partnership with the Chinese Computing Federation. So basically, think of the national equivalent for China of the ACM. It was interesting because, as you mentioned, when I was in high school, I went to high school at the United Nations International School, and there we had the ability to ask the UN to send a teacher to teach us any language we wanted to learn if we could get 10 students to sign up. So with a group of friends, I looked and we saw, okay, China is the largest country in terms of population. It should be important to learn Mandarin. So managed to convince 10 of my friends to be able to go and sign up, and we actually studied Mandarin. I unfortunately haven't practiced it as much as I should have ever since, but it was interesting that I still had enough left to be able to go and greet my counterparts at CCF in Chinese, which surprised them. They weren't expecting it. So it was interesting to see the results, at which point then I said, okay, now I'm going to have to switch back to English because I haven't studied it as well as I should have over the past 30 years, and it gets kind of rusty when you don't practice it every day.
It's kind of a fascinating story. A Renaissance person, I mean, you're multilingual, so.
You know, when you actually speak two languages fluently, so the idea is I am, you know, fully bilingual, French and English, and, you know, what that does, it means learning another language is actually very easy once you actually master two. So I've learned many other languages. I mean, I taught in Algeria and then in Tunisia for several years and learned Arabic while I was there. You know, learned German as well, learned Spanish as well. And find that picking up another language, once you've actually gotten your head around the fact that there isn't only a single language, then becomes much easier. And I found that with very many people who I meet who are bilingual, picking up another language once you already are bilingual is much easier than for somebody who's only spoken one language for most of their life.
Alan, you've taken us on this incredible sort of journey through this discussion, and now we're down to our last question, and it's a bit open-ended in that if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Okay. Let me give that some thought and see. I think the most important question that I would ask is where the major challenges still lie. Okay, and in terms of not the technology, but what's important and where, you know, where we should be taking the technology. And for me, the key challenges that I see, so since I'm asking the question and answering it too, let's get to that and see. It's the thing that concerns me the most and that I want to make sure that we're paying proper attention to is the whole notions of loss of privacy that we're seeing now with the ability to be able to get just about any bit of information that you would care to find on just about anybody at a moment's notice. It's surprising what you can find through a simple Google search. Now with tools like Facebook, like Twitter, like LinkedIn, you can find much more information about just about anybody. And what that's done is that's changed the notion of what's private and what's public. And I'm not sure that most people fully understand the implications of that and how widespread it is and what the implications on society are. I have discussions with my sons. I have two boys, one's 22, one's 26. So at an age where they're very active in social media and sharing many things, some of which you look at and have a talk with them about and say, you know, that may not have been the most appropriate thing because that will never go away now. Anybody who's looking to find out about you will find that piece of information. Is that really what you want your potential employer 10 years from now to find when they look for you? And to get them to think about what it means and what this access to information means in terms of your personal life is still something that I find we don't quite have our heads around. There's a lot of good questions being asked. I'm not seeing the answers that I would hope to find showing up just yet.
You know, myself and the audience, we've had this opportunity to dialogue with one of the top leaders, innovators, and brains on the planet. And Alain, I know your schedule is very demanding, and yet you took the time to do this interview. So thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
You're welcome.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Alain Chenet, top global innovator, serial entrepreneur, executive, and scientist.